This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A number of studies confirm that growing up below the poverty line can have serious health implications. But can it have a lasting effect on the brain? As part of NHPR series The First Decade, we're considering how living with a constant sense of scarcity can actually hijack the neural pathways to the brain, affecting decision-making for a lifetime. Eldar Shafir is professor of psychology and public affairs at Princeton, where he studies human behavior and decision-making in the context of poverty. He's co-author of the book Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. Eldar Shafir, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
You go through a lot of historic and contemporary research to reveal the psychology of people struggling to manage with less than they need. Less what?
Basically not having enough of whatever resource it is that you are lacking on. If you don't have enough time to do all the things you would like to do in your everyday life, you're having scarcity of time. If you don't have enough money to take care of the things that you consider, you know, essential for your everyday living, then you don't have enough money, et cetera. It could be calories if you're dieting. It could be friends if you feel lonely.
We know that trauma actually changes the way that stimuli is received in the brain. Can the experience of scarcity change the brain, or is this just going on in the mind?
We, Sandal and I, do not do brain research directly. There is certainly evidence of chronic effects of trauma of living with poverty over years. In some sense, what we do is a little bit different. We look at the momentary effects. We can take somebody and make them poor in time or money. And within a very short time, what you find is that they now devote a lot of their attention to this area where they're feeling poor, where they're not having enough. You end up what we call tunneling. Everything else on the side turns into a kind of fuzzy periphery. We describe in a book a beautiful study where they looked at a school in New Haven where the train track was near one side of the school but pretty far from the other side. And they compare the performance of fifth graders who were randomly assigned to one side or the other. And the kids who are near the train tracks after 5 years at school are about 1 year behind in academic performance, which is, you know, a massive effect. The case we're making in the book is that when you don't have enough finances or you're worried about rent or food or anything of that sort, it's like an internal train. It's like these trains going through your mind and interfering with your ability to manage, you know, the rest of your life calmly and well.
So this would, I can imagine, really reduce opportunity for somebody if their brain was doing other things, worrying, perseverating. But something else that you present in the book, an actual lack of imagination. People can't see themselves outside of this cycle.
You know, it's a part of the tunneling issue. As you're doing that, you're living a very, very focused life that neglects a lot of other things that would have been great to take advantage of, including things that could hurt you again, you know, worse tomorrow. So in some sense, we talk about a poverty trap. As you're neglecting things in the periphery, some come back to haunt you. You know, bills you forgot to pay, loans you took at interest rates that were, you know, excessively high, but to which you paid less attention as you're trying to solve a problem today. And all these things end up only making you poorer the next week.
As you pointed out, scarcity is sort of relative in many ways. Not just a poverty trap, but for super, super busy people, there's a scarcity of time. Give us an example of how that might sort of spin out for them.
Well, I'm guessing a lot of your listeners will have had this experience where you're basically running around through a day where there's too much to do and there's a deadline, you know, at the end of the day or the next morning, and there's just not enough time to attend and spend a lot of time focusing on your kids' homework or paying attention to your spouse's, you know, laments about something that happened to them that day. You're tunneling on the problem you have. You do much less well elsewhere. You might sleep less well because you're pulling an all-nighter to get the project done. the next day, there's data on this, when you've spent a night without sleep, you're just a little bit less smart and you do things less well. Very similar to the money issue with the poor.
How about the idea of tunneling for good? I mean, we recently interviewed a woman who wrote about Sherlock Holmes' kind of obsessive behavior in solving crimes. He kind of rides that obsession, that spinning wheel. Can it be used for good?
Well, it's a wonderful question, and it's a very important aspect of our work. If you look at how the poor manage their everyday funds, they do extremely well. They use their dollar. They manage the dollar much better than the rich. They buy things typically very, very carefully and wisely. They know how much they spent on a jar of tomato sauce as opposed to many of us who do not really notice it. They're managing things very well. They're kind of experts on a day-to-day juggle. But as they're juggling so well locally, again, they neglect things in the periphery, some of which are, you know, financially highly relevant to their lives. And so you find this in many places. You know, the students I see every day, when they pull an all-nighter, when they spend 8 hours a day, you know, they finally, after months, disconnect from email and disconnect from Facebook and just sit down and have only 8 hours left and write a paper, they're good at it. You know, many of us joke that what you see people do in college is not the best they can do, but the best they can do in the last moment. Mm. And, you know, they do very well. But the point is that as they've done very well throughout this night of pulling an all-nighter, everything else is neglected. They forget to call their mother on her birthday. They don't sleep as well. They eat less well. Everything else in the periphery is neglected. But again, as you point out, the act of focusing can lead you to very high performance at that moment, very locally.
We're speaking with Eldar Shafir. He is co-author of Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. Well, you write about some of the ways that public policymakers and health workers can accommodate or be sensitive to this tunneling and actually help build bandwidth. What are some examples of creating bandwidth?
Here's one way to think about it. We walk around with a very limited mental capacity, very limited bandwidth. We can only attend to a few things at a time. And that's kind of an interesting way to think about it, because what that means is that anytime you give me a little bit of bandwidth somewhere, a little bit of a bandwidth gift, I have more of it now to attend to other things. To the extent that you make my banking easier, more trustworthy, more automatic, more manageable, at that moment I can spend less time juggling my banking and I have more time to, you know, eat well or attend to my kids' homework or anything else I want to do in life. And so the intuition here is, what can policymakers do, especially for people who struggle with poverty? Poverty, in some sense, you know, we're talking about different sources of scarcity as if they're all the same, but in many ways, poverty is a more extreme case. You know, many of us who are very busy, you know, between us, don't tell anybody, you know, this is something we choose to do. We don't have to do it this way. I mean, many of us who are busy because we're trying to, you know, exercise and go to the opera and read a good book and do good work and do better work than the other people around us and stuff like that. And, you know, if we fail to do one of those things, at the end of the day, very often nothing much happens. When you're poor in money, it's a very different story. There, if you fail to pay the rent in time, you're evicted. If you fail to get food on time, you're hungry. It's a much more extreme version of it. Mm-hmm. And so the notion is, what can policymakers do to alleviate some of that juggling, tunneling that's required of the poor to manage their everyday lives? And paradoxically, what you find is that, you know, the less poor often get a lot more help than the poorer. So, you know, we get reminders and automatic deposits and overdraft coverage and friendly banking and all kinds of things, and lawyers and accountants and drivers and nannies and maids and all the kinds of things that help us manage our everyday lives. And basically, for a little bit of money, we get more time. When you look at the poor, the whole thing is much more complicated. It's very hard to get more money for your time. You can work another hour or two and sleep a little bit less, but that's not going to give you much. And you often get a lot less help. You have less reliable lawyers and less friendly banks and less good instruments that help you save for retirement in automatic and painless fashion and all the kinds of things that would make life a little bit easier. So the intuition is that if policymakers design a context where, for example, the poor can resort to short-term loans without going to payday lenders who charge an enormous amount of interest, if we simply made short-term loans available that are not too expensive, there's some evidence showing that would make the financial lives of the poor so much easier to manage, thereby liberating some bandwidth and allowing them to do other things in their lives a lot better.
Well, although the circumstances for the very poor are different than most middle-class Americans, there is a psychological state. You know, one of my friends calls it the disease of more. You know, there's never quite enough success or money or attention. Is scarcity a psychological state? And is that something that we can work our way out of?
Well, we certainly talk about it as a psychological state, as a sense of a feeling of not having enough. And whether you can work it Out of it or not depends a bit of where you are. So, you know, I'm very reluctant to suggest that people who have a hard time finishing the month and feeding their children should work on having more modest tastes.
Mm.
It is certainly true that in many cases, you know, both, you know, the richer who feel like they don't have enough money or the very busy who just take on too much and could easily do with less, there it's certainly true that you could imagine, you know, very smart ways of making things better by just, you know, developing slightly more modest wants and needs. It's a deep issue because there's often a critique about work that's done on the American poor, saying, what do you mean they're poor? They all have, you know, TVs and
cell phones,
toasters and cars
and what.
Exactly. And that's sort of it's an interesting critique because it sounds sort of superficially like you got a point there, but it really is not very deep. And, you know, imagine I said to you, what do you mean they're poor? They all have running water. That just doesn't seem right. You know, things that used to be a luxury once now have become a basic feature of everyday American life. Yes, internet used to be an unimaginable luxury 20 years ago, but today, when it's a common staple and your kid at school basically needs internet access to do her homework, if you can't afford it, well, then yes, you're poor. And so in some deep way, there is a psychological element to it because as society changes its norms and its standards, what it means to be poor will change with them in the sense that there's certain things that you feel you ought to be able to afford and all of a sudden you can't.
Eldar Shafir, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Eldar Shafir is a Princeton-based psychologist and co-author of Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. You'll find more in that book and everything from our special series, The First Decade, including Brian Walston's story on the challenges kids in poverty face when it comes to mental illness. It's all on our series page for The First Decade at nhpr.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. I've never been the type to change the oil in my own car. I prefer to leave that to the professionals. But it is comforting to know that if I chose to learn how, I could pop the hood and do it myself. And yet, the increasingly computerized nature of automobiles and a far-reaching 1998 copyright law threaten the ability of home mechanics and tinkerers to make DIY repairs to their very own vehicles. Kyle Weens is founder of iFixit. That's an online community that creates and shares free repair guides. He's also a contributor to Wired magazine, where he recently wrote a scathing op-ed entitled, We Can't Let John Deere Destroy the Very Idea of Ownership. He's here to tell us more. Kyle, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So there are two parts to your opinion piece. The first, pretty easy to grasp, that cars are more computerized, so they're just harder to tinker with. The other problem, however, is that owners are not allowed to tinker with certain parts of the car. Now, how can that be?
Well, we are adding electronics into everything. And there is a different set of laws that regulate electronics than regulate other types of property because electronics have software in them. And so you have copyright law that governs what you can do with digital works, like saying that you can't copy a movie or you can't copy an MP3 file. Manufacturers are using the same laws that restrict copying of digital products to limit what we can do with our physical, real products like cars.
And when you talk about copyright laws, one specific Digital Millennium Copyright Act in 1998 kind of was set up to govern this line between software and hardware. What does that DMCA, as they call it, cover?
Right. So this is an update. This is U.S. copyright law. And there's a specific piece of it that says that in addition to it being illegal to copy things that you don't own, it is also illegal to break locks that protect access to the content. So it's like a car manufacturer saying, hey, if you open the hood of your car, you avoid the warranty. Okay, fine. You can do that if you want. But they're also saying we're going to pass a law to make it illegal for you to open the hood. That's really what the problem is that's impacting tinkers, mechanics, even people that want to fix their iPhones.
Well, what specifically then does it restrict? What can't you do?
What you can't do is modify the software that's on these devices. So if you have a car and you want to modify the engine tuning, they're saying that it's a violation of copyright law to go in and change a parameter in your engine.
All right. So you mentioned the iPhone. What are some of the other products that consumers are effectively locked out of?
Yeah, so the biggest challenge for day-to-day consumers has been people that weren't even trying to fix things. They wanted to use their cell phone and take their cell phone. Maybe you bought a phone with Verizon and you wanted to take it to AT&T. There's a lock on the phone that locks it to Verizon. Doing that switch requires undoing that lock, and the cell phone carriers have been saying that changing that lock over violates copyright law.
So this is being challenged right now, and the U.S. Copyright Office is deciding in July which high-tech devices we can modify or hack. Now, we know that John Deere and General Motors both submitted comments to the Copyright Office for this, but you put John Deere squarely in the crosshairs. Why that company in particular?
I have a lot of friends, other farmers. I live in a farming community in San Luis Obispo, California. And there's a lot of people here that grew up, they are used to being self-reliant. They've been buying tractors, they've been working on farms their entire lives. Being a farmer sort of is the definition of self-reliant. Oftentimes you're miles away from civilization. You have to be able to figure things out on your own. And a friend of mine, a farmer named Dave, came to me and said, "Hey, I have a tractor and there's a sensor that's malfunctioning. And when the sensor malfunctions, the tractor won't go." And so I called John Deere and they say, "Well, we can have a technician out with a new part in 2 days. And he says, "No, you don't understand. That's not good enough. I have to have the tractor out in the field during those 2 days." And so he wants me to help him bypass this sensor. Well, I can't do that without modifying the software on the computer. So this is a very common problem that's impacting more and more farmers as electronics move into farm equipment. The same issue that prevents you from unlocking your cell phone is also preventing farmers from maintaining their own equipment. This is all about control. This is about who has the right to do what with the things that we own. Is it us, the people that own it, or is it the people who made it and sold it to us? And the manufacturers are trying to extend their sphere of control to everything that you ever do with the thing that they made, even though you paid them good money for it. They're saying, "No, you only bought the physical product. You didn't buy the license to be able to continue to operate it."
Okay. So what are some of the modifications you think people should be able to make to their vehicles?
Well, there's a lot of common sense things that you might want to be able to do. You might not realize this, but farmers are constantly tinkering and creating new farm implements. If you buy a John Deere tractor, it's kind of like having a blender or a mixer in your house. If you have a KitchenAid, there's all kinds of attachments you can hook onto the KitchenAid. It's the same thing with a tractor. Tractor is horsepower, and then you attach various things to it to do what you're going to do in the field. Well, sometimes they'll want to add a new sensor onto their farming implement and hook it up to the tractor to get power. Some repairs you need to be able to go in and modify engine timings. You might need to turn off a fan or something on the engine so that you can get in there and work on it. So normal repairs, you're in there, you're doing all kinds of things. And this idea that the people who made it in the first place know exactly how it's going to be used for its entire life is just preposterous.
I'm speaking with Kyle Weens. He's founder of the free online repair guide iFixit, about the very idea of what it means to own your own car. He says car companies like General Motors and industrial equipment makers like John Deere are making it hard or impossible for home mechanics to access software integrated into their vehicles. He argues that if you can buy it, you should have the right to repair or change it. But companies like John Deere and General Motors, they're liable if something goes wrong with their equipment, right? I mean, what do you say to companies concerned that tinkering could jeopardize safety or even emission systems built to comply with federal standards?
Yes, this is something that the manufacturers bring up repeatedly. They say, "Hey, you know, we've got liability for the products we put out there." And we say, "Well, people have been fixing cars for decades, and it hasn't been a problem." I'm a software guy. I'm a software engineer by trade, and I can tell you there's no difference when it comes to starting to tinker with computers. They might seem complicated and harder, but we have the same issues dealing with making sure that we do repairs safely on electronics that we have had making sure that you repair your brakes safely is something that independent mechanics, that tinkers in their garages have been able to do for decades, and there's no reason we can't continue to do that.
How about security, however? If operating codes for cars becomes accessible, does that make it easier for a hacker to infiltrate a car's computer system, potentially really hurting somebody?
Sure. So this is a good argument. And the question is, should locksmiths be the only ones that are allowed to take locks apart and figure out how they work? And I can tell you, if you have to have a license in order to figure out how locks work, what you're going to end up with is locks that aren't very secure because nobody is taking them apart to give the manufacturers feedback to make sure that the lock is designed in a secure fashion. So one of the exemptions that we applied for was specifically for security researchers to be able to investigate cars to find problems with the cars so they could share it with the manufacturers. Because if you think about a criminal, they don't care about copyright law. If they're planning on you know, breaking into cars to steal them or whatever they're going to do, they're not going to be paying attention to any existing copyright laws. They're just going to do it. The people that this law really limits are the security researchers, the professors, and engineering students that are trying to make our systems more secure.
I'm thinking that if consumers have to bring their cars to authorized dealers for repairs or have them come out into the field in the case of the tractor, what does that do to this American tradition of grease monkeys, the third-party mechanics? Is it in danger of collapsing because of these copyright laws and the sheer complexity of new vehicles?
I think it's a concern anytime you tell the next generation, you tell children, no, you're not allowed to take things apart. Because if you think about it, who are the engineers who design the things that we have now? Engineers get into it because they're excited. They want to understand. They want to learn how things work. Children are naturally curious. I was at a maker fair over the weekend, and we showed kids a cell phone, and we said, hey, do you want to take a cell phone apart? And their eyes just lit up. They got really excited because they've never seen the inside of a cell phone. So in order to make sure that we get people excited about science and engineering and technology, we have to maintain this tinkering spirit, or America is going to lose ground to other countries that are more willing to teach people at a young age how things work and how to make them.
So this review is coming up in July. What can consumers do now?
The Copyright Office is doing a short-term review. Every 3 years they review and they grant limited exceptions. But what we really need to do is fix things. So Representative Lofgren from California has introduced the Unlocking Devices Act, which would solve this problem permanently. That's really what we need. There are also a number of states, Minnesota and New York, have introduced fair repair laws, trying to even the playing field between consumers and manufacturers.
Carl Weens, founder of iFixit. It's an online community that creates and offers repair manuals. Kyle, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Kyle's essay and articles have appeared in several publications, including The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and Wired, where we found his article about John Deere and the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. You'll find a link to read it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. According to federal law, producing marijuana can still result in decades in prison. Yet in Northern California, there's a whole economy built around it. They call the area the Emerald Triangle, marked by Humboldt, Trinity, and Mendocino counties. In Mendocino specifically, the gradual decline of the lumber industry led to marijuana becoming one of the county's major commercial crops over the last decade. Cultivating and selling marijuana for medical use is legal in Mendocino County, but of course, there's a gray area when it comes to federal law and how much you grow. KLW's Daphne Matiriaki spent a day behind the scenes on a pot farm in Mendocino to find out how it all works and brings us the story.
The marijuana farm is on a dirt road between Mendocino and Conche, around 2.5 hours from San Francisco. When I get there, the gate is wide open. It's a beautiful plot of land.
We look out over conifer trees to a valley with a beautiful ridge on the other side. This is like a million-dollar view.
Literally. This is one of the owners of this very profitable operation. We'll call him Tom. He works with a couple to run this farm. We'll call them John and Amy.
When we started here, this entire area was all like a struggling apple orchard.
John moved here with Amy and their daughter 8 years ago to grow weed. At the time, John was a carpenter and Amy a teacher.
She drugged me out here because her entire family migrated.
First, he had to learn the basics of farming marijuana, but quickly he became an expert.
After 3 years of living in California, I started experimenting with like organic farming, and that changed everything, really, on quality and yield and everything.
Now the garden has 25 marijuana plants, each about 6 feet tall. John's partner, Tom, is also a chef and a winemaker. He compares growing weed to growing grapes.
The process is very similar. You know, with bud, it's like it's about the crystallization. You look at it, the color, how it's finished, various things like that.
And these traits translate into quality and profit.
We're probably making about $1,000 profit on every pound.
So how many pounds were there, you said?
About 170. So $170,000 divided by two, that would be 85,000.
And that's one outdoor growing season. They also grow indoors. So in a year, they're potentially making over $500,000. Untaxed, of course.
So now are we going to the drying room?
This is the drying room.
Oh, it smells of marijuana.
Yes, it does. So this is an actual indoor growing facility that we converted into a drying facility just for
the time of the outdoor harvest.
The buds hang here for about a week after being harvested from the plants. When the indoor growing begins, this room will be filled with seedlings grown under artificial light.
No, we do 99 on the indoor.
Is that allowed?
That's the federal allowance. Anything over 90, yeah, anything over 99 plants, the federal government can prosecute. The mandatory minimum in California.
They could prosecute you for one, but they wouldn't mess around with that, basically, is what you mean, right?
No.
So let's pause here for a minute. Because this is where the legal gray area gets grayer. Even Amy and John don't seem to know where the law stands. See, John, Amy and Tom have a license from the county to grow 25 plants for medical use. But obviously, at 99 plants, their indoor facility would far exceed that. The rule of thumb among growers is if you stay under 100, you're safe. I called a local dispensary to confirm this, and the director said federally, even one plant is illegal. But a grower is more likely to be prosecuted if he grows over 99 plants. Last year, the partners say their harvest was interrupted by federal helicopters. Agents came down on ropes and chopped down their entire crop. That's about $200,000 worth of weed.
It's such a weird gray area. For us, they came in and they chopped them, but they didn't prosecute. But if we would have had 100 plants, they could have brought in the federal part and prosecuted for mandatory minimum in California.
Which is 5 years. But his wife, Amy, says that she doesn't lose any sleep over their business.
Compared to some people have 1,000 plants.
And
those people are afraid all summer long.
After the weed is dried, it's time to trim it.
I'm picking up a bud and then taking off the big leaf and then making it into a pretty shape and cutting the stem.
Inside a tent, there are grocery bags of weed everywhere. People have come here from all over the world to trim.
I'm from Canada, from Vancouver, and I live in Mexico.
This woman has been here for 2 months, but others have become local full-time trimmers.
I've lived in Mendo for just over 4 years.
At first, this local trimmer had a regular tax-paying job.
And, of course, you can't necessarily make a living off of that. And when you spend a little bit of time here and learn what the industry is here, you learn that that's actually how you can either supplement an income or change your income completely.
It's long, mind-numbing work. But if the weed is easy to trim, a fast worker can turn around 3 pounds in a day, making about $175 per pound. Apart from the financial benefits, she says there are other perks that draw people here.
I think a lot of us are calling our present job site Weedtopia. We have a chef who is cooking for us every day. They provide us with anything that we ask. Music, entertainment, good conversation, the random people that you meet. It's all fantastic.
I find two other trimmers on their lunch break who have been in the business for a long time.
My parents grew growing up, so I started trimming like 8 years old or so.
For me, I would say kind of off and on from when I was about like 16 until now. I'm 34 now. And
for them, the marijuana industry is a way of life. They believe in the healing and the medicinal values of the herb. But they're still not open about what they do.
Obviously, when I meet a lot of people, it's not the first thing I tell them about myself. I mean, I am a mother, too.
The entire community is in a similar position. For instance, the growers, John and Amy, have a 7-year-old daughter who regularly comes in and out of the farm. They say it's normal for her.
Because that's what all of her friends' parents do as well.
Even some of her teachers. But there is a very clear social rule around here.
If I'll go into my daughter's school and talk to somebody, a teacher or somebody else there, you know, they would never, ever ask you what do you do for a living? Because they know better, because they don't want to like put you, they don't want you to put you in a position where you have to lie to them.
Perhaps the most dangerous part of the pot growing operation comes at the very end, the delivery. It's the riskiest step because it means leaving the safe haven of Mendocino.
It's going to Los Angeles. That's our hub.
Who takes it from here to go to who? I mean, I don't want to
me. Me. Yeah, me.
How much? So you drive with how much weed on you?
Legally, 49 pounds at a time. With our particular license, 49 and under, you have a really good case. But anything over 50 and up, you're in big trouble.
And where do you put the weed?
In the back of my trunk.
Like what in?
In bags.
Okay.
Duffel bags.
Is your heart racing when you do that?
No, it's just, I have my whole little like.
It's a mindset.
It's a mindset. I just blow kisses and say, Daddy will be back in 3 days, and I go.
And are you worried?
Mm-hmm. I try not to think about it. And then when I get the message, somehow he'll get a message to me that he's there. And then I'm, whew, yeah.
Despite the high risks and uncertainty, John and Amy actually prefer their business stay as it is, illegal. They're afraid of what would happen to their bottom line if they had more competition. But their partner, Tom, sees it differently.
You still can get your price if you do a boutique, high-end quality product. It's the same in the wine.
Would you rather it be legal or are you?
I don't care, because it's no different than growing grapes. There's always a high-end market.
And just like at the end of a grape harvest, this weed growing season ends with a party. All the workers gather around a big bonfire, burning what's left of the marijuana plants. You can almost forget that these people are in hiding, because they're hiding in the open. In Mendocino, I'm Daphne Mazziaracchi for Cross Currents.
Here's a situation that might sound familiar. A calorie-counting colleague or a concerned mom or a fat-averse friend presents some freshly baked goods announcing, and there's no sugar. Yes, we could all stand to eat less fat and sugar, but what do you do when it comes to dessert? That was a challenge for Joanne Chang, the chef owner of Boston's Flower Bakery and Cafe. That'd be the bakery with the motto, make life sweeter, eat dessert first. But the pastry chef, who graduated from Harvard with a degree in applied mathematics and economics, seems quite up to the task. Joanne is out with her third cookbook. It's called Baking with Less Sugar. And Joanne Chang, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Well, you've built 4 flower cafes now and written 2 cookbooks based on making addictive sweets. Are you turning your back on sugar?
You know, when I first started writing the book, I was worried that people would think that I was trying to shun sugar entirely. But that's actually not the case at all. In fact, it is because of my love of sweets that I went towards this book. I wanted to see if I could create desserts that had less sugar but more flavor. And that's what I found out when I started experimenting with desserts and pastries that had less sugar. If you reduce the sugar in many desserts, what you end up with is a pastry or a cookie or a cake that has so much more flavor that you're surprised at how much sugar can mute the flavor of something.
What do you need to have more of on hand if not using or using less sugar?
Well, it depends on the recipe for sure. In the book, I do focus on different sweeteners. There is one chapter that is entirely made with recipes that have less sugar. So there's still white sugar in them. And so you don't need anything special in your cabinet, but you're just going to use less sugar. For example, there's an oatmeal raisin cookie where we reduce the sugar by less than a quarter of the original amount. Mm. But what we do is we increase the vanilla, we increase the cinnamon, we take some of the raisins that are in the oatmeal raisin cookie and we chop them up really fine so that when you eat the cookie, you taste sweetness, but you really get to taste the oats and the raisins and the walnuts and all of the other flavors in the cookie. And then in the other chapters, we have a chapter that focuses on honey as a sweetener. There's another chapter that focuses on maple syrup and molasses. And then we have a fruit chapter and then finally a chocolate chapter.
Mm-hmm. I have to admit to being haunted by a home ec teacher that said, cooking is an art, but baking is a science. You have to do it exactly. You know, so people may be less likely to experiment. There are chemical combinations that make ingredients into thickening or stiffening agents. Now, what does sugar do other than sweetening in recipes?
That is, you know, it's funny. One of the reasons why I personally love to bake so much is because of the science aspect of it, the chemistry of it all. And sugar does so much more than just sweeten. I thought the main challenge of the book was going to be finding out ways to trick your palate into not missing the actual sweetness that comes from sugar. But it turns out that was the easy part. The hard part was figuring out how to bypass all of the different chemical reactions that don't happen when you don't have sugar. So, for example, one area in which sugar is really, really helpful is sugar, when mixed with butter, causes a lot of leavening, which translates into lightness and tenderness in a cake or a cookie. So when you don't have sugar, you really have to figure out how to create a texture in the cookie that's still light and fluffy but doesn't have the power of sugar. Another amazing thing that sugar does is for frozen desserts, any sort of ice cream or frozen yogurt or sorbet, sugar allows that frozen dessert to be scoopable. And when you have a frozen dessert that doesn't have sugar, you end up with something that's really, really hard, like ice. It's essentially frozen like ice. And so, again, you have to figure out ways around that so that you can have a dessert that might taste great without the sugar, but has the consistency of something very different from what you're used to.
Well, let's just consider some flour favorites. You are very well known for your sticky buns, which triumphed on the Food Network Throwdown with Bobby Flay. Here he is in just a quick clip describing them.
It's the perfect sticky bun. A study in delicious sweetness.
Now we take all of this goo and spoon it over each bun.
I mean, it's just absolute heaven. The perfect sticky bun. You know what that's saying? Eat me.
That makes me want to eat a sticky bun.
Well, I see in the book, you know, you have honey cashew morning bread, you have monkey bread, no sticky buns. Is it not possible to make your champion sticky buns with less sugar, Joanne?
Well, it's definitely not possible to mimic exactly what we have as the original, but the honey morning cashew bun is very close to the sticky bun with a couple of big differences. We don't use any white sugar in the honey bun. What we do is we substitute honey. And it turns out honey is a really strong flavor, and honey combined with cashews also is very powerful in flavor. So you end up not needing a lot of honey. You can just use a little bit of honey, and then there's definitely some cream, and there's butter that's in the dough, so it's a really rich pastry, and it's not as sticky and gooey, but it's still really, really flavorful. And it's the same with the cinnamon sugar monkey bread. We just use a little bit of white sugar. It's less than a quarter of the amount that's in the famous sticky bun. But what ends up happening is you have a monkey bread that is light. The dough itself is really light and fluffy. And then there's a kind of a cream sugar caramel that coats each of the monkey bread nuggets. It's a different experience from the original sticky bun, but I would argue it's as good as, if not better, than the original experience.
Well, sure, we could all use a little less sugar in our lives, but how about baking with less sugar? Well, we're talking with the renowned pastry chef Joanne Chang of Flower Bakery and Cafe in the Boston area, and two cookbooks about flour bakery recipes, and now a third cookbook. This one is called Baking with Less Sugar. You also use apple juice and grape juice concentrates, which you make yourself. How do you make them?
So what we do is we actually buy frozen apple juice concentrate from the can, and then we reduce it. And after you boil it for about 10 or 15 minutes, it reduces down and it becomes more syrupy. And then we use that to make a bunch of different desserts. So one of my favorites is the carrot pineapple cake with cream cheese frosting. This is a carrot cake that is made entirely without white sugar. And it's only sweetened by the juice of the apple juice and then also the natural sweetness of the pineapple. And we reduce the apple juice, we make it into a syrup, we mix that into the cake batter, and then similarly, we take reduced apple juice and mix it into the cream cheese and the butter to make a cream cheese frosting. And I firmly believe that you could serve this cake and not tell anybody that there's no sugar and nobody would notice.
Is that the test, the pass test?
That is for me. I didn't want to create desserts that you had to offer with a caveat. You know, I didn't want to say, well, here's this new cookie, but there's no sugar in it. So, you know, eat it with a grain of salt, so to speak. I wanted people to be able to enjoy these desserts. And then after the fact, if you wanted to let them know, hey, there's no sugar, then I wanted them to be surprised. But primarily, the first priority was to make sure that the flavor was right. And then I worked on reducing, and then figuring out how to substitute either a different technique or a different ingredient to make it so that it had less sugar.
Sugar has so much meaning for so many of us. There's oftentimes a relationship that we have in our memory with sugar and eating sweets, and between consuming sweets and happiness, or even as a consolation for sadness. What does it mean for you?
For me, so I did not grow up in a household that had sweets. I wasn't really introduced to sugar until pretty late in my probably early teens. But up until then, the only sugar we really had in the house was fruit, just natural fruit sugars. My mom and dad always snacked on fruit. We always had fruit for dessert. And it wasn't until I got a little bit older and I started to get invited to my friend's house for dinner that I learned about all of the different kinds of desserts that were out there.
Well, I wonder, is there any part of you that when your customers ask for less sugar, do you just think, well, you don't have to eat the whole pastry in one sitting?
Yes and no. If people ask for gluten-free, that's harder for me to relate to simply because of the name of our bakery, flour. So I have a hard time sometimes with that, in that I feel like flour is kind of the mainstay of what we do. But less sugar, sometimes I do think, okay, just eat less and consume in moderation. But honestly, I do agree that there are a lot of desserts out there that just are made with too much sugar. And I think that our palates get used to consuming more and more sugar, and there's ways to make your palate less craving that taste. And one really simple way is to simply start consuming less sugar. The less sugar you consume, the less you crave it, and then you are really happy and satisfied with desserts that aren't quite as sweet. And I think my whole upbringing has been, you know, not focusing on super, super sweet things, and thus my palate is already naturally inclined to less sweet pastries. So sometimes when people ask for less sweet pastries, I agree with them. And I think that's a reason why I wanted to write this book, was to show them you can still bake and bake really well and be really proud of what you're making and not have as much sugar in your desserts.
Joanne Chang, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Joanne Chang is author of 3 cookbooks, most recently Cooking with Less Sugar. She is also a co-owner with her husband, Christopher Myers, of Myers and Chang Restaurants in the South End. And now 4, is it? 4 flour cafes?
Now we have 4 bakeries, yes.
4 flour cafes and bakeries in the Boston area. You can find much more about the book and about her restaurants at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And while you're there, you can see all the stories from NHPR's special series, The First Decade, including some infographics on the income gap between single mothers and families headed by married couples, and House by House. It's a digital story that shows some of the disparities in the lives of New Hampshire families on the other end of the income spectrum. All those stories and more on our series page for The First Decade at nhpr.org. And don't forget to share it with a friend. After all, the most interesting educational things can travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow, too, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray,
with help from our intern,
Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.